coincidence, a phenomenon that is never given the credit it deserves. Some people may see it as luck, karma, fate. Others may see coincidence as divine intervention or divine punishment, and there are those that will pretend they never notice it. The power of coincidence is always underestimated and unseen until at any random moment two seemingly unrelated events occur at the same time, with chances so minuscule you'd think it could never happen. I thought the same my whole life. Some things happen that are small, sure, maybe a little spooky at times, but nothing life-altering or life-ending. At least that's what I thought. The thing about coincidences is that you can never see them coming, never plan for their happenings or keep track of their existence. They are birthed into the world in an instant and leave just as quickly. One coincidence has changed my life forever. Partly my own fault, partly bad timing, partly unavoidable circumstance. It was bound to happen to someone eventually, so why not me? The coincidence, so simple, so powerful, was this. A cup of tea and a clumsy person occupying the same space at the same time. At this current moment, I am sitting in a chair just after having pushed a button. The button was located in the upper left corner of the console that laid before me. It was larger than the other buttons, but not oversized, red in colour with the word launch written on it. I sat in the seat in front of the console, wrapped both seat belts around my torso, and clicked them in to create a large, stabilizing X right across my chest. I take a deep breath, hesitant to press the button, but my cowardice persuades me to do so. After an on-screen, 3-second countdown, I heard a sequence of noises, the hatch door locking, the air pressurizing, the thrusters firing, and then, after a few seconds, the thrusters lessen, and I am greeted to a message from the escape pod voiceover, informing me that the launch was a success. I now sit in this chair, in this one-man escape pod, and look out the small circular window to my right. I gaze at the city-sized starship I was stationed on as an engineer. I gaze at it and think about the events that led me to flee. The series of events start on a planet now 3/4 of a light year in the opposite direction and end with me sitting in this chair. The planet where I was born and raised was corrupt and vile, full of narcissistic and powerful figures who have no care for the little people. Organized crime syndicates ruled the planet's resources, wealth, and population, split evenly amongst 3 families. The only part of the system the families don't control is the military. They have managed to stay uncorrupted by the influence of the 3 families and have a 0 tolerance for any dealings with them. The syndicate that controls the province where my family have lived since the first settlers had their claws dug deep into all aspects of life. When I was 16, they offered me money and power and sex, everything one desires, and all I had to do was a simple favor. Once that favor was done, they asked me another, then another, until I was caught in a perpetual spiral into the dark world with dark people. For years, I climbed ranks, betrayed friends, and broke morals my mother had worked so hard to instill in me. When she died, collateral damage in a revenge shooting, one that my men were part of, it broke me. I looked into a broken reflection and saw a face of evil staring back, one covered with blood of innocence with the devil's hand wrapped around their neck. Looking into the black eyes of that corrupted soul, they told me to run. Run and never look back. So that's what I did. I left and told no one. I forged documents to get onto the military starship as an engineer, and within 3 days I had left everything never to return. My biggest problem I had to deal with now was remaining undercover aboard the starship. It was easy enough to go about my business for the first half light year once the ship was travelling at light speed. All 600,000 crew aboard had their own jobs and routines they would attend to each day. Each section had its own captains and executive officers. Communication between the 13 sectors became paramount to keeping the starship running. I remained in the fuel sector. Once the initial thrust achieved light speed, the ship makes stop every half light year for waste disposal, hiring, executing prisoners, etc. It was also half a light year into the journey that my cover started to show cracks, and eventually it shattered. Coincidence struck like lightning. I left my bunker at the exact moment the executive officer walked past, hot tea in a lidless cup one moment and covering their chest the next. As her adrenaline rose from heated water and social embarrassment, I was berated by questions and demands, the most threatening of which informing them of my name and rank. I knew that my file was on the system. After all, I had put it there myself after boarding the ship. Forged documents may make it through the boarding security, most of whom are overworked and underpaid, unlikely to pay proper attention when adding the files into the ship system. But it's unlikely the XO will take any leniency when investigating my file. Like I said earlier, the military has zero tolerance for family dealings, and once they find the file was forged, they'll arrest me without trial. My only option now was to escape. I could hide for a few weeks at most, but eventually they would find me. Working in Sector 13, at the back end of the ship, always hot and crowded, fuel stench staining everything from clothes to food, had one perk. The reason I chose to remain in this sector, the fuel itself. For safety reasons, the fuel stock was kept in a vacuum-sealed room. No oxygen means no way for the fire to spread if any amount of fuel becomes ignited. No danger to the rest of the ship. For this reason, all crew members are fitted with a pressurized spacesuit, 6 oxygen canisters that can be emptied into the rebreather, 1 for each shift. In the fuel sector, crew work 6 shifts with an off day at the end. They are required to refuel their canisters on their off day ready for the next week. My suit allowed me to blend in. I went into fuel storage for a place to work, to hide. Just after entering, a message came across every speaker and screen in Sector 13, along with lights turning to an alarming red. The message read, "All crew, prepare for emergency stop. Code E53-B. During emergency stops, once all the maintenance is done, all crew must enter a stasis section of their sector, allowing for the ship to slow down faster than normal without injuring the crew. This stasis room was filled with thousands of tubs full of blue gel. You sit inside the gel, press a button, and it hardens like jelly. Anything inside is safe from sudden stops. A code E53-B, unknown attacking forces stationed in the starship's momentum path, meaning if the ship were to remain at its trajectory, it would crash into whatever was in the way. Now normally, this isn't a problem for small things like asteroids. The shields can handle them. Small scavenger ships, colonists, and miners can get clear from the path in time. But this code meant someone had intentionally placed themselves in way of the ship. I could not believe the timing. Not only did this mean the XO and their military police stopped searching for me, it also, more importantly, allowed me to leave the ship. Once the ship had come to a safe speed to exit the stasis, I headed for the escape pods. The preparation for potential battle was the perfect cover for me to weave my way through the rooms towards the exit pods. There were 6 different escape pod sizes, ranging from 1 passenger to 60. I fitted myself into a single-man pod and looked at the button. That leads me to now, this current moment after just having pressed the button, watching 2 ships, each the size of a city and collectively harbouring over 1 million people, firing giant weapons at each other for an unknown reason, only because someone had ordered them to do so. As my pod flies further away from the ships, I can see the enemy. I guess I have no need for that word now. I am a traitor, or a deserter, or whatever name you see fit for me. I watch these leviathans spit flames and poison at each other as I have watched them do so the past few hours. Each second they get smaller as I get further away, but their behemoth size still covers the majority of my window. Then, through sheer coincidence, each ship decides to resort to the final, last act at the same time. Each starship has a single nuclear warhead in its possession to be used in dire straits. There is a whole sector of the ship devoted to keeping it safe and stable. I watch as each ship fires this weapon of annihilation. The same weapon, or at least its ancestor, was used centuries ago to defeat the invasion force that attacked Earth in the year 2083. Back then, all of the human race existed on one planet. Now it exists in 4 different star systems. The invasion force all had the world's powers work together. At once the threat had been burned with nuclear fire, the powers went back to what humans have always done, to war. This time, war was different, though. The invasion had left technology unfathomable to any man beforehand and sparked a new race, not to the moon this time, but to the stars. Each ship fires their nuclear warhead at the same time, and each nuclear warhead ignites into the other ship simultaneously. As my pod drifts away, a tear rolls down my cheek. Partly from the beauty of the 2 exploding starships, creating a dance between 2 hydrogen clusters, each filled with atoms nuclei tearing themselves apart. It is perhaps the most beautiful thing I have ever seen. The colours and intense light, the growth and unpredictability of the blast, it reminds me of the binary star system of my home world. The first time I went into space and saw it with my own eyes was an addiction. 2 stars, one yellow, the other orange, circling each other for eternity, like two lovers forbidden to touch. That is what I see now, the same physics on a smaller scale. A second tear rolls down my eye as I think about all the people aboard those ships who have been incinerated. Soldiers who signed up for this, military personnel and high-ranking officers, they all knew that this was a potentiality. But the cooks, administration staff, cleaners, scientists, the teachers, they all came aboard in hope for a new life in Wolf 359. They will never get to live that life out now, due to some war that will never achieve anything but death. They won't get to live their life, but I will, because I left them. They remained, and I fled, and now I am the one that's alive. That is the thought that caused the third tear to stroll down my cheek. As I looked out the window at the two blossoming explosions, catching onto the fuel and feeding on it, a small black spot appears. It gets bigger. It grows exponentially in size. I rack my brain trying to work out what could be growing in size that quickly in space. Then I realize it isn't getting bigger, it's getting closer. Before I have a chance to do anything, the debris has already smashed into my pod, tearing the thrusters off the back and sending the pod into a spiral that will never stop. The speed throws me back in my chair. I can't move. The centripetal force is infinitely stronger than I am. I think I would die now. That would be fair, joining those who I should have died with on that ship. But I don't. The piece of debris that tore off my thrusters was only the first in a hailstorm of others. Each piece of broken ship hurtles towards my minuscule pod, forcing it to obey its commands. There is no semblance of reasoning with what is happening, only to survive. The spinning has slowed as smaller pieces of debris now smash into my pod, straightening it out. I slump into my chair. The noise of metal smashing into itself is deafening. The air in my pod carries the noise straight to my ears. As the noise becomes more sparse as the debris does, I recollect myself. I sit up and undo the safety belts holding me. As I stand up in the slowly drifting pod on a path to emptiness, no way to set myself on course to a location, I hear a crack and a sizzle. I witness the console screen shut down and the console itself catch fire. The smoke fills the cabin and the fire starts to spread. The console fully ignites and I know I have only seconds to do something before it ignites the oxygen canisters attached to my suit. I have only one option. To remove the oxygen is to remove the breath that gives life to the flame. I look at the hatch and press my hand against the emergency release button. I take a deep breath and push it in. The hatch depressurizes and flies off. As all the air in the pod violently flees, I am pulled out with it. I drift now, watching the pod slowly get smaller and smaller. I feel as if a newborn who has been pulled from the womb without warning, thrust into an unknown world with nothing to guide them except for their own thoughts. That is me now, drifting endlessly in the endless drift. When you're a child, you think your home is huge. As you get older, you think a city is ginormous, and when you travel, you start to understand the true grand scale of the world, the true size of it. None of those feelings come close to how I feel now. Nothing, not even a planet or a sun, can come close to the size of space. Everything else is insignificant. The expansive, unimaginable size of space truly deserves the term endless void, because as I float along without any control of my direction, I finally understand there can be no end. It contains everything. While the size is awe-inspiring, yet terrifying, the scariest, yet most beautiful part of space is the silence. You may live your life in peace, secluded or tranquil. You may think when you lie in bed, the world is asleep, no sounds around you, that you have experienced silence, but not like this. To imagine silence is to imagine the absence of sound, but this is more than that. It is its own meaning, the silence of space. It is enough to turn a man insane. The only solace now is the sound of my oxygen pump filling my rebreather. Without it, I may have lost my mind already. I've lost track now how long I've been meandering. When I was hurled from the pod, I counted the seconds between oxygen pumps. 113 exactly. Then I started to count the number of pumps. I lost track around the 200 mark. I angle my head up. The direction does not exist in space. I know that in my head, but in relation to my body, I move my chin as far away from my chest as I can. I see a distant sun glimmer off floating metal now populating the once empty space. Like the slums of Earth, the debris crowd each other, bumping and drifting to and from one another, sporadically finding their own way through the abyss. I realize I'm headed for the debris field. Without any choice, I'm going back to where I fled. Drifting now through the debris field, I am intrigued by how much of the ship didn't get vaporized. I suppose if the warhead hit the head of the ship, then the back part would have been pushed from the force before the heat could melt it all. The explosion still tearing it into thousands of pieces, but not to the extent that I thought was the only outcome. Everything drifts at such a slow pace, like old ladies strolling through a botanical on a bright Sunday, taking their own pace, no need or care for any aspect of anything else, just simply existing and moving in a way they need to. I suppose if the debris was sentient, as I am, it may have the same thought about me. It may think to itself, what is that strange thing doing floating between us, trying to copy us? I would say to the debris that it should not be so mean. Just because I am shaped different and made from organic material does not mean that I cannot be debris like them. Perhaps I am debris. We both came from the same place. We both float without control of our emotions, and we both have no one left but ourselves. Of course, there are thousands of pieces of them spread around this emptiness, and only one of me. Or perhaps there are thousands of pieces of me spread around this emptiness instead. I dream of soil. I dream of gravity. I dream of my mother. I'm awoken by an object bumping me. I grab it before it drifts out of my reach. It is something so otherworldly from my current existence that I think I have finally gone insane. If talking to the debris didn't do it, then this would. I hold in my hands something so beautiful, something I had given up the hopes of ever experiencing again. A book. Coincidence has once again showed me its hand. The chances of me and this book floating into each other's way is so slim. All the places the book could be and all the spaces I could have gone, we have both ended up in this same position, floating towards one another like magnets. Purpose unknown. The title on the cover of the book has dumbfounded me as much as its existence has. Poems of the Old World, it read. Where this could have come from has my mind lost in itself. The Old World, pre-extrasolar colonization Earth. Poems, a dying breed of literature. With the expansion of population, the digitization of so much, communication between systems so elongated, poems are now self-contained within their own circles. Each system has famous poems and poets, but seldom few are published. The only reason this book would be on the ship would be a family heirloom, perhaps. A new life in a new system, new generations to care for this book as the previous ones have. That legacy has now ceased to exist. There is no one to take care of this book, no one to take it home and hide it, keep it safe for their children or grandchildren. No one except me, of course. I decide that I will now make this book my family heirloom. I've never visited Earth, nor any of the United Solar Nation colonies. My ancestors first colonized from the Soviet Alliance, and those that colonized there came from Mars. I suppose Mars was initially colonized by humans. So, retrospectively, I guess I am part Earthen. The book is hard to read in the dark of space. I turn on my headlamp to illuminate the pages. Many of them are torn or burnt, or the writing had worn and become illegible. Some of the poems, however, are in pristine condition. The first one that I can read, on page 27, is titled Dulce et Decorum Est, written by a young man in the events of World War I. How long ago that was. The war to end all wars. How naive. I read the poem once, and a second time. The footer of the page contains a translation for the final part of the poem. The last lines are these. You would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory that old lie, dulce et decorum est, pro patria mori. The translation, from Roman, is this. You would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, it is sweet and proper to die for one's country. And with those lines, my heart implodes. I am drifting through a graveyard of bodiless corpses, vaporized out of existence, each of them someone's son or daughter, once children. Their lives were taken in an instant because some people with power decided their way is better than someone else's. How stupid. I fall asleep to the sound of my oxygen pump. I dream of my book, my beautiful, wonderful, ancient book. I dream of reading it. The pages full of wonder and stories I could never have imagined. I dream of sitting on soil, reading my book. My mother is sitting next to me, listening as I read my favourite poems about war and love and life and death. I read the last poem in the book, one I have not seen before. It is titled, You. I read it. It terrifies me. I read it and at the bottom, before I can finish the poem, an orange leaf and a yellow leaf falls on the page from the tree above me. I turn to look at my mother, who was always smiling, my entire life from cheek to cheek. I turn and look at her. She does not smile now. She looks at me with terror in her eyes. I look down to see she is bleeding from two holes in her stomach. The bleeding runs and runs and fills up the entire area. I try to stop the bleeding, but when I do, I start bleeding instead. I'm crying. I look at my mother and ask what happened. She replies, "You." I wake up crying, partly from the twisted dream I've just experienced, partly from the hunger I feel in my whole body, as empty as space I now call home. I have four oxygen canisters left. I feel for my book, tucked under one of the straps in my spacesuit. I pull it out and read the poems people have written from their lives, from others' lives, from emotion and from reason, from love and hatred. They comfort me in this immense loneliness and warm me in the bone-chilling cold. I have drifted now almost through the wreckage of the ship, so far from where I was reborn from the pod, yet not having moved at all. I look around me at the behemoth of debris in which I am a traveller, a visitor, a friend. I read a poem, Ozymandias, a once great pharaoh of Egypt called Ramses II. The poem talks about a man that meets a traveller who tells them about walking in the desert to find a colossal broken statue. The final six lines of the poem ruminate within my mind long after I finish reciting it to my metal friends that cannot hear me. And on the pedestal these words appear, "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. I read these lines and weep. I think about the traveller I met from an antique land, how they have given me so much knowledge and comfort in the lone and level sands I am wandering in. I look around me at the colossal wreck and yell as loud as I can, "Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." Only I hear myself. My metal friends do not know how important they are to me. I sleep again, and as I do, I dream of my home. Laying in my bed in my tiny room, I sit up and rub my eyes. When I open them again, I'm not in my tiny bed in my tiny room. I'm in my bed in my quarters on Sector 13 aboard the starship. To the bed next to me is my exo, spilled tea across her chest. I get out of bed and walk out the door. I'm no longer in Sector 13. I'm in a desert. Nothing surrounds me except for billions and billions of grains of sand. In the distance, I see a glimmer. I look towards it. In an instant, the glimmer is at my feet. I have not moved there, but the distance has been travelled. The glimmer is my book, my beloved book, my best friend. I pick the book up and open it to read my scriptures, my testaments, my poems. I open to read, but nothing remains on the pages. They are as bare as the desert I exist in. I flick through the book, empty. Empty except for the final page. On the final page, there is one poem, "You." I try to read the end of the poem, but the leaves are still there. The orange and yellow one overlapping one another. No trees exist around me, but the two leaves exist in front of me, like yin and yang. I pull the leaves. They do not move. I pull and pull, but nothing happens. I look up and see the exo standing in front of me. I slump my head and cry. As a tear falls on the leaves, they become loose. I grab the end where the leaves overlap. I pull them to reveal the rest of the poem. I tear them off, but instead of words, the leaves become explosions. Two hydrogen clusters, each filled with atoms nuclei tearing themselves apart. They grow, slowly in my mind, and start to encompass me as I look back at the exo in front of me. They are repeating the same question, over and over, my name and rank. I scream and ask them what they want. As the explosion grows larger, destroying the desert, the exo grabs my head and whispers in my ear, "You." I wake, crying again, hungry no more. I have lost the sense of hunger, of pain, of despair. I am tired, yet all I do is sleep, sleep and read. My hunger is not killing me, not yet. I still have two oxygen tanks left, so I will not die soon. I decide to do it myself. I decide that I will take my helmet off and suffocate myself. It may be painful. The depressurization will tear my organs out through my mouth and ears and eyes. It may be painful, but it will only be for a few seconds. It will not last an eternity. I have lived for an eternity out here, and I will live no longer. My friends that surround me will exist here for eternity. So will my holy text I hold in my hands. I tuck it back under my strap in my spacesuit. I take one final breath and reach for my helmet. I undo the clip around the oxygen tube that feeds into my helmet. I close my eyes, and I pull. I concentrate at a distant star, flickering on and off like a dying light bulb, and think about my circumstance, my spacesuit and its fail-safe system. The helmet cannot be removed if the outside pressure is different from the inside. How stupidly wonderful. I decide the next piece of debris that comes into my reach, I shall grab and pierce a hole in my suit, allowing the oxygen to escape, leaving me an emptied corpse in a spacesuit coffin, clutching their best friend and drifting eternally in their own desert. As I drift, waiting for my tool to grace my presence, I read the next poem in the book. This one is titled, "Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night." The top corner of the page has been burnt and the bottom quarter is torn. All I can read is two parts of the poem. I recite them over and over again. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight and learned too late they grieved it on its way. Do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death who see with blinding sight. Blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. I look again at the flickering star. It seems to be slightly brighter and slightly larger than it was before. I stare at it and wonder about what colour it may be, its size, the planets that orbit it, and on those planets if there are families, mothers that smile, and children who disappoint. The star flickers. It does not come back. Something is blocking it. It is a piece of debris, headed straight for me. This is what I have been waiting for. I dream now of standing on a planet. There is a family in front of me. A father who sits and watches a mother chase her son and daughter around. They are laughing and the mother is smiling. I look up and see a sun. It flickers over and over and then it stops. In the dark of a burnt-out sun, I look back at the family. They are standing in front of me. They all wear spacesuits, the same ones all the crew wear aboard the ship, now gone. One stands there, lifeless. The next has two holes in their stomach, bleeding. The third has a piece of debris shoved into their helmet. Cracks form throughout the visor. And the fourth stands there, holding a book. My book. I ask them who they are. In unison, they remove their helmets and reply, "You." I wake, not crying. I float, as I have done for my whole life. I have now passed the colossal wreck and am back into the emptiness. My last canister has been emptied into the rebreather. I know that this is my last. I open the book. I have read almost all of it. Only a few remain. As I am reading, the lights on my headlamp start to fade, and before reading the last poem, they die. I think to myself that the lights have died before witnessing the last poem, just as I will. I try to read, but it is futile. There is no light source close enough to illuminate the pages. The book forms a rectangle of blackness surrounded by distant stars. I close my eyes. I open them to reveal my book, now illuminated. I am shocked and pleased and confused. I shake my body to turn around. I see what is happening. A ship. A small ship approaches me. A scavenger, no doubt. Come to reap what they can from the debris field. But they fly past the debris field. They are headed for me. I am shaking. Partly from the lack of nutrition and oxygen. Partly from disbelief that I am being saved. Before the ship reaches me, I let the light illuminate the last poem in the book. Before turning the page, I notice something sticking out the bottom, ever so slightly and ever so thin. Two of them, to be exact. I turn the pages carefully, not to harm whatever treasure the pages encompass. I turn the page to reveal two leaves, tucked in between the last page and the back cover, an orange and a yellow. I pick them up and reveal the last poem. It is titled "You." I read it, but the leaves, from their eternity of rubbing the page, have removed the final lines in the poem. I close the book and grasp it tightly in my hands, almost hugging it. The ship opens its bay and encompasses me. I am the leaves and the ship is the book, hugging me like a mother to its newborn babe. The door closes and the room depressurizes and oxygenates. The pilot enters the room and helps me take my helmet off. I take a deep breath of oxygen. I cough and in a raspy voice ask the name of the pilot. They reply, "You." I look at the book I am holding. But it is no longer there. I think to myself, "You. What an interesting coincidence."